We're going on to part two tonight, but we had the questions from the 50 pages from page 49 to 93 from part one. Now, any of you not found the answers to those, or are you satisfied with that? Of the questions, perhaps? Second sheet of questions now. Does anybody need the first sheet, which is page 149 and 49 to 93? If you look at the first set, the first handouts, we have questions. How did Moses receive the knowledge of his divine mission? The answer is ...53 to 55 is the description of the case, and it says, while returning, Moses entered the Holy Valley. Situate in the wilderness of Sinai, and there beheld the vision of the King of Glory from the seat that belongeth neither to the east nor to the west. Now you recall we spoke about this tree being neither the east nor the west. And there he heard the soul-stirring voice of the Spirit speaking from out of the kindled fire, bidding him to shed on Pharaohic souls the light of divine guidance. And again we have this Baha'u'llah identifying in his own tablets, he identifies himself with the speaker on the mount. He identifies his revelation and his reality with the reality that spoke to Moses in the burning bush. What are the twofold signs that have announced the revelation of each of the prophets of God? We've gone into that in the last class in detail. Why does Baha'u'llah cite the records of past sacred books? Question 3. He says that he's done this, that happily the poor of the earth may attain the shores of the sea of wealth, the ignorant be led under the ocean of divine knowledge, and that they that thirst for understanding partake of the salsadil of divine wisdom. Otherwise, this is page 63, otherwise this servant regardeth the consideration of such records a grave mistake and a grievous transgression. In other words, as a concession to us with our ideas of what's right and what's true in the past, the manifestation of God cites verses from traditions, from the holy books of the past, to make his point. Well, Baha'u'llah is really beyond that entirely. I mean, doesn't need to depend on whether such a verse was in the Quran or such a hadith was left by some imam to make his point. But out of consideration that happily somebody will see the similarity of truth and be more receptive to the message, which was the whole purpose of God sending a revelation, is to draw people under God, he uses those methods which will attract the hearts and confirm them. In that connection, Abdu'l-Bahá also speaks about this works both for omission and commission of use of certain stories and things in teaching. He says that as the purpose of God is to bring people to the faith of God, to bring, move the soul to God, and the teaching work is based on that, that we wouldn't want to introduce anything in the teaching, in our teaching of the faith, from the teachings themselves, from our own teaching, that might act as an impediment upon which a soul at that stage in its development would trip over. In other words, you go to a person who has a drinking problem and you say, you know, I have the solution for you. Baha'u'llah has a religion, he forbids drinking. That'll fix up, you join the faith, that'll be it, you'll solve your problem, you know. Before he knows anything about it, he doesn't want to know anything about it. That's an extreme instance, although that happens sometimes. I've heard people teach that way. But there is then the combination of using the knowledge that we have from the teachings with wisdom in teaching. And Baha'u'llah stresses how much we should use wisdom in teaching. And I think wisdom has a lot to do with sequence and weighing the needs and weighing the capacity of the listener to bear any particular truth at the given time. So in our teaching work, we want to think about that. Now Baha'u'llah also, instead of giving just his own pure words, he weaves in these past traditions. He uses something that's familiar to the reader to attract them. In the same way you're teaching, you may have to make reference to Christ in certain parts of the world where you're teaching, where people have knowledge of the Bible. If you don't mention the Bible, suddenly they say, you've been talking about God, you haven't mentioned the Bible, what's the matter with you? They start doubting. As soon as you can quote something from Jesus, they relax. Oh, he believes in Jesus, so the Baha'is believe in Jesus. And it opens the way to be able to teach. And one is always watching the signs, how to move the soul through this maze of problems that they have, of the way they understand certain words, of certain concepts that are a problem for them, you know? And until the warmth of their being can be enkindled, you can enkindle some recognition, some attraction, some interest. Now you've seen in teaching where sometimes souls start attacking you. You know, I know in Latin America, lots of times you teach someone, you see that they're attracted, and suddenly they switch gears and they start saying, but the church says this, and the Pope this, and I don't know what, all these Catholic arguments. And usually this is kind of the last movement before the old self dies. You know, they have to bring up all this, you know, and they try to make a defense because they feel themselves being drawn and attracted to the faith, and they'll start attacking you on the grounds of this. So you have to be patient with that kind of thing in teaching work too, and move forward, still move forward, lovingly. If it's like you have a hold on them, don't let them go, and lovingly explain each point and so on. Sometimes when they get very aggressive, you think, gosh, I don't want to argue. Of course, you shouldn't argue. But don't always believe everything that they say they believe. And don't always believe that they believe it. Because usually they don't believe it, but they know it from, it's like rote learning from tradition. They have to say it, you know. Well, what do you say about this? What do you say about that? It's a very interesting experience on teaching people in different places and different continents. And some of you have been teaching on all different continents, and some of you have taught on more than one continent. I was just thinking about Mishak going off to America now. He's teaching in Africa, and they're serving in Asia, and he's going to go to America. Faith gives us wings more than we imagine. How does Baha'u'llah describe the inner state of the manifestations of God? You'll recall that was quoted from page 67. these ancient beings, though delivered from the womb of their mother, have in reality descended from the heaven of the will of God. Though they be dwelling on this earth, yet their true habitation are the retreats of glory in the realms above, and so on. The two kinds of knowledge, divine and satanic knowledge, we dealt with last week. Four symbolic meanings of the term clouds, page 71, 72, 73, 74, 75, 76, has quotations on all of that. What does Baha'u'llah foretell concerning the future of the cause of God? You find that one? Page 78. He says, ere long thine eyes will behold the standards of divine power unfurled throughout all regions and the signs of his triumphant might and sovereignty manifest in every land. The meaning of angels, pages 78 and 80, we also dealt with that. By angels was meant those who, reinforced by the power of the Spirit, have consumed with the fire of the love of God all human traits and limitations, and have clothed themselves with the attributes of the most exalted beings and of the cherubim. Why have Christians denied the manifestations of God subsequent to Jesus? Page 80. As the adherents of Jesus have never understood the hidden meaning of these words, and as the signs which they and the leaders of their faith have expected have failed to appear, they therefore refuse to acknowledge, even until now, the truth of those manifestations of holiness that have, since the days of Jesus, been made manifest. So, they're missing three of them since then. And Buddha, but that wasn't easily accessible to them. What is the term perverting the text refer to? Verily, by perverting the text is not meant that which these foolish and abject souls have fancied. The corruption of the text is meant that in which all Muslim divines are engaged today, that is the interpretation of God's holy book in accordance with their idle imaginings and vain desires. There are other answers to that, all between pages 87, I think it is, 84 over to 89. The warning given to the people of the Bayan, we dealt with that last week, it's on page 92 and 93. Take heed and be watchful and remember that all things have their consummation in belief in him, in attainment unto his day, and in the realization of his divine presence. Come to part two. Remember that there was a paragraph heading part 1, and likewise there's one in part 2 on page 97. Again, the text of this is in Arabic, and then it follows by Persian explanation. Verily, he who is the day star of truth and revealer of the supreme being holdeth for all times, for all time, undisputed sovereignty over all that is in heaven and on earth, though no man be found on earth to obey him. He verily is independent of all earthly dominion, though he be utterly destitute. Thus we reveal unto thee the mysteries of the cause of God, and bestow upon thee the gems of divine wisdom, that haply thou mayest soar on the wings of renunciation to those heights that are veiled from the eyes of men. The significance and essential purpose underlying these words is to reveal and demonstrate unto the pure in heart and the sanctified in spirit that they who are the luminaries of truth and the mirrors reflecting the light of divine unity, in whatever age and cycle they're sent down from their invisible habitations of ancient glory unto this world, to educate the souls of men and endue with grace all created things, are invariably endowed with an all-compelling power and invested with invincible sovereignty. For these hidden gems, these concealed and invisible treasures, in themselves manifest and vindicate the reality of these holy words. Verily God doeth whatsoever he willeth, and ordaineth whatsoever he pleaseth. The top of page 98, halfway down the page, is cited from the Gleanings, section 19 of the Gleanings. And also there's two quotations there that are found in the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, this whole section of patches of extracts that Shoghi Effendi has used in several places. To every discerning and illumined heart, it is evident that God, the unknowable essence, the divine being, is immensely exalted beyond every human attribute, such as corporeal existence, ascent and descent, egress and regress. Far be it from his glory that human tongue should adequately recount his praise, or that human heart comprehend his fathomless mystery. He is and hath ever been veiled in the ancient eternity of his essence, and will remain in his reality everlastingly hidden from the sight of men. No vision taketh in him, but he taketh in all vision. He is the subject of the all-perceiving. No tie of direct intercourse can possibly bind him to his creatures. He standeth exalted beyond and above all separation and union, all proximity and remoteness. No sign can indicate his presence or his absence, inasmuch as by a word of his command, all that are in heaven and on earth have come to exist. And by his wish, which is the primal will itself, all have stepped out of utter nothingness into the realm of being, the world of the visible. Gracious God, how could there be conceived any existing relationship or possible connection between his word and they that are created of it? The verse, God would have you beware of himself, unmistakably beareth witness to the reality of our argument. And the words, God was alone, there was none else beside him, are a sure testimony of its truth. All the prophets of God and their chosen ones, all the divines, the sages, and the wise of every generation, unanimously recognized their inability to attain under the comprehension of that quintessence of all truth, and confessed their incapacity to grasp him who is the inmost reality of all things. Now that presents us with the first picture, the relationship of creation to God, the essence. He goes on, he says, the door of the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, in other words, God, the essence, being thus closed in the face of all beings. Then he explains how we come to have any relationship with him. So we'll take some notes of this first part. Previously, we've talked about how the manifestations of God have pre-existence. You recall there's a letter from the Guardian. It says, the prophets, unlike us, are pre-existent. The soul of Christ existed in the spiritual world before his birth in this world. We cannot imagine what that world is like, so words are inadequate to picture his state of being. Someone had asked about, did Christ have existence before he appeared here? And this is something that's been affirmed in various ways in the writings. And I also heard that in the Bob's writings, I think I've mentioned this in the previous class, that he, in one of his tablets to the divines, actually, he says that ere he chose the moment to appear within his mother's womb, that he repaired and had consultation with Muhammad. And they decided what would be the fate of the Shia divines for their wickedness, and then they set out three stages of punishment for them, three stages of that would end up finally in their downfall. And the second stage, just before the downfall, is that they would be raised higher than they've ever been before. They would, in other words, have political power and everything. and appear to be at their highest stage of prestige, and then they would be reduced to nothing in the future. So this is a kind of suggestive passage from the writings of the Bhagavad Gita. Sent down from their invisible habitations under this world, I think it is, really. This outer world of existence, to educate the souls of men and endue with grace all created things. Now, in the writings on creation, we find that there are three worlds of existence described. You have them symbolized in the ring stone as the three lines of the conditions of existence. The first being the world of God, which is infinite, limitless, and perfect. Baha'u'llah has been speaking about here in these paragraphs. The second is the world or kingdom of command, which is the reality of the holy manifestations of God, their universal reality. It's also the primal will that we've seen mentioned in this passage and in others. And then there's the world of existence itself, per se, the world of creation, which results from the influence of the primal will on nothingness, if you will, calls into being out of nothingness. These worlds of creation, which are both visible and invisible, because so many of the invisible worlds, those worlds where the souls dwell after death, are also created worlds. You know, we say, well, we go to the kingdom, but in that sense, the kingdom is a created world. There's some further explanation about that. It's in Semantic Questions, page 295. There are various passages in Baha'u'llah's writings where he talks about the purpose of the manifestations of God. Here he says it's to educate the souls of men and imbue them with grace. There's another passage in the Gleanings, page 79, where he says that God's purpose in sending his prophets unto men is twofold. The first is to liberate the children of men from the darkness of ignorance and guide them to the light of true understanding. The second is to ensure the peace and tranquility of mankind and provide all the means by which they can be established. So you have both this inner personal enlightenment, and then you have those teachings and spiritual principles which order outer society and provide for the peace and tranquility of the world. If you look up in the concordance of Baha'u'llah's writing, the word purpose, you'll find other purposes mentioned. It's an interesting study. The verse at the bottom of page 97 is found in Baha'u'llah's writings in various places. Itself, in its original form, it's in Arabic, it's a composite of two Quranic verses, Surah 14, verse 27, and Surah 5, verse 2. 14, 27, and 5, verse 2. On page 98, he talks about, far be it from his glory that human tongue recount his praise. Baha'u'llah sheds further light on this in one of the prayers you find in Prayers and Meditations, page 194. He says, every praise which any tongue or pen can recount, every imagination which any heart can devise, is debarred from the station which thy most exalted pen hath ordained. How much more must it fall short of the heights which thou hast thyself, the heights which thou hast thyself immensely exalted above the conception and description of any creature. For the attempt of the evanescent to conceive the signs of the uncreated is as the stirring of the drop before the tumult of thy billowing oceans. Now you see the little drop wants to encompass the infinite billowing seas of God's reality. It doesn't quite have what it takes. He goes on to say, I render thee thanks that thou hast taught thy servants how to make mention of thee, and revealed unto them the ways whereby they can supplicate thee through thy most holy and exalted tongue and thy most august and precious speech. On the one hand, he tells us we can never find words adequate to praise him and to recount his bounties. On the other, he provides through the word of God those very verses whereby we can fulfill that condition. But for thy leave, who is there that could venture to express thy might and thy grandeur? And were it not for thine instruction, who is the man that could discover the ways of thy pleasure in the kingdom of thy creation? Everlastingly hidden, he says here. Again, Baha'u'llah, in a tablet cited in the World Order of Baha'u'llah, page 113. From time immemorial, he, the divine being, hath been veiled in the ineffable sanctity of his exalted self, and will everlastingly continue to be wrapped in the impenetrable mystery of his unknowable essence. Again, he says, he speaks about no tie of direct intercourse. Skip 2 pages. That's another one. No tie of direct intercourse can possibly bind him to his creatures. In the Gleanings, page 192, he says, he is and hath been one and alone, without peer or equal, eternal in the past, eternal in the future, detached from all things, ever abiding, unchangeable, and self-subsisting. He hath assigned no associate unto himself in his kingdom, no counselor to counsel him, none to compare unto him, none to rival his glory. Again, we have a major reference here to the primal will. By his wish, which is the primal will itself, all have stepped out of utter nothingness into the realm of being, the world of the visible. This theme is found in numerous passages in the Baha'i writings, and also particularly in the Bab's writings, you find it too. In the 7 proofs of the Bab, he's written the following. Know thou that the first remembrance, which is the primal will of God, may be likened unto the sun. Primal will as the sun. God hath created him through the potency of his might, and he hath from the beginning that hath no beginning caused him, now he's identifying the primal will with a manifestation, caused him to be manifested in every dispensation through the compelling power of his behest. And God will, to the end that knoweth no end, continue to manifest him according to the good pleasure of his invincible purpose. It is this primal will which appeareth resplendent in every prophet and speaketh forth in every revealed book. In the time of the first manifestation, the primal will appeared in Adam. In the day of Noah, it became known in Noah. In the day of Abraham, in him. And so in the day of Moses, the day of Jesus, the day of Muhammad, the apostle of God. The day of the point of the Bayan, the day of him whom God shall make manifest, and the day of the one who will appear after him whom God shall make manifest. One of the few places we have reference to a subsequent manifestation of God. Hence the inner meaning of the words uttered by the apostle of God, I am all the prophets, inasmuch as what shineth resplendent in each one of them hath been and will ever remain the one and the same Son, the primal will, the world of command, the world, the inner world of the manifestations. We'll be coming back to the dual reality of the manifestations. On the one hand, that's their reality. On the other hand, they have an individuality through which they appear in creation, in time, with their own name, their own titles, their own purposes, their specific mission, their exact designation, their time, their point in time when they appear in contingent, in the contingent realm. You can find that in other passages in selections from the writings of the Bab. That particular one's on page 126. This is interesting, this one. God would have you beware of himself. And now this obviously has the face value of meaning. This term, himself, or his self, sometimes translated that way in different passages, it also reminds us of one, I think we've had this, perhaps previously we'll be coming to it again, where it says that God is... I've lost it with this interruption. We may have to send help out there, I don't know. Anyway, I'll catch this one again. Something about himself. He has known God, who has known his own self. And this has an obvious meaning. It's been understood by the mystics and written about. You know, if you know your own true self, that's as close as you get to knowing God. It has that meaning. Baha'u'llah, in one of his tablets, takes it a stage further and he says there's another meaning inherent in this, where his self, his own self, or his self, is actually a reference to the self of God in the manifestation of God. In other words, that's another implication of this. He who hath known himself, or he who knows him, knows... How did I say that? I'll ask it again. He hath known God who hath known his own self. So the meaning also is, he hath known God who hath known the manifestation of God. Now we come to the same double meaning in this present verse. God would have you beware of himself. It has an obvious meaning, where the term himself is understood by scholars to refer to God. But this passage also seems to conform to that other one, where Baha'u'llah's use of the expression self of God at times refers to his own self, the manifestation, and the other prophets of God, their reality. So God would have you beware of himself also. Beware of the manifestation of God. I mean, beware in the sense of showing full respect. God was alone, there was none else beside him. This verse has also been explained, I don't know the cross-reference here, but it's been explained in the gleanings in one tablet, where he says that, first of all, God, there's nothing that can compare to God, there's nothing that you can put next to God. Everything, when you compare it with God, is as nothing. It doesn't have any existence. It's a relative existence. It's the essence of nothingness when brought into the light of the face of the sun. It's like any... What if the shadow have to... How can a shadow reach the sun? How can these things happen? So that's one aspect of it. With regard to the prophets of God and their own inability to recognize the essence of God, this is another mystery. We've spoken about the how certain principles, certain truths operate at each stage in different ways. They have different levels of operation. our own inability to recognize God, of course, is there, but the likeness of the manifestation of God not being able to recognize the essence of God is similar to us not being able to recognize the essence of the manifestation of God. It's the same relationship. In other words, we know God, we know the manifestation of God. If you don't know God at all, he's telling us here. We know the manifestation of God to the degree to which our own inner being is receptive, or the mirror of our hearts is cleansed and is directed towards his light. The amount of light that enters the mirror of our being, or the stirring that invisible light causes within the gem of our own reality, is what we understand about the light of the manifestation. We believe in him because he lights us up, not because we attain to where his light comes from or what is the reality of his light and his nature. And again, this is the same thing. He hath known God, who hath known his own self. In other words, the self, the higher self that's mentioned in Seven Valleys, speaks about that self which is pleasing to God, that self which God loves, not the lower self which is not so helpful to either God nor man. That self is the means of capturing the light of God. It is the, he says, this gem, this repository of the divine, ancient divine mysteries of God, the soul of man, the soul of human reality. Now, the manifestation of God, it seems, in his universal reality, which he has a reality, he says, that encompasses all things, his sovereignty, he exercises undisputed sovereignty over all created things. Not back from his station higher, but down from his station. So when he says he's omnipotent over everything under him. When he says he's the all-wise, the all-knowing, his knowledge is everything in the realms of being and creation. But they themselves explain that this door to the hidden reality of the essence of God himself is also close to the manifestation of God. He beholds that power in his own reality and in the authority that he exercises with creation, the love that he feels for creation. At least this is what I understand by these passages, and obviously beyond all of us to figure it out. In the Gleanings, for example, he says in another, in a similar way, he says all the embodiments of his names, embodiments with an uppercase E, in other words, the manifestations of his names, wander in the wilderness of search, athirst and eager to discover his essence. And all the manifestations of his attributes implore him from the Sinai of holiness to unravel his mystery. And again he says, 10,000 prophets, 10,000 prophets, each a Moses, are thunderstruck upon the Sinai of their search at his forbidding voice, thou shalt never behold me. Whilst a myriad messengers, each as great as Jesus, stand dismayed upon their heavenly thrones by the interdiction, mine essence thou shalt never apprehend. This is Gleaning 61 and 62, pages 61 and 62. But by the time you get there, if you just read that, you would think, well, how shall we ever know and worship and love God, which we're told is the purpose of creation? Page 99, goes on. The door of the knowledge of the Ancient of Days being thus closed in the face of all beings, the source of infinite grace, according to his saying, his grace hath transcended all things. My grace hath encompassed them all, hath caused those luminous gems of holiness, the manifestation, to appear out of the realm of the Spirit in the noble form of the human temple, and be made manifest unto all men, that they may impart unto the world the mysteries of the unchangeable being, and tell of the subtleties of his imperishable essence. These sanctified mirrors, these day springs of ancient glory, are one and all the exponents on earth of him who is the central orb of the universe, its essence and ultimate purpose. From him proceed their knowledge and power. From him is derived their sovereignty. The beauty of their countenance is but a reflection of his image, and their revelation a sign of his deathless glory. They are the treasuries of divine knowledge and the repositories of celestial wisdom. Through them is transmitted a grace that is infinite, and by them is revealed the light that can never fade. Even as he hath said, there is no distinction whatsoever between thee and them, except that they are thy servants and are created of thee. This is the significance of the tradition, I am he himself, and he is I myself. This is also the reason that we come later in the book that the manifestation of God identifies himself with God. He speaks to us and he says, verily, verily, I am God. There is no God but me. And Baha'u'llah explains that in such moments that the manifestations utter such things, that any hint that there is an intermediary, the manifestation stands between the power of God and the believer's heart, would be blasphemy. So in that sense, he adopts the voice of the first person of God and speaks to us in that way. But we should distinguish that that's different from the essence of God. But on the other hand, he says that the essence of belief in divine unity is that anything you see in the manifestations, their actions, their words, their deeds, their exhortations, you should identify that with God and his actions and his purpose. There's no difference. They don't stray from the purpose and will of God in everything that they do. So if there's something that appears mysterious or tests us, God has some wisdom in that, some purpose in that. Besides, then we have, of course, all of the examples of their lives and of the attitude that they have towards their enemies and all the different lessons that they give us through their actions and their deeds. Across the way, you'll see this other mysterious saying, man is my mystery and I am his mystery. Because of this connection of the manifestation, drawing the power and light of God from this first world of God, through the world of command, the inner reality, the manifestation of God, and showering and infusing that grace, energizing human souls, receptive human souls, through the influence of the mission and the words that they bring us. This pattern is complete. Man has this mysterious thing in himself. When that light shines in him, he's no longer just a human being. He has some added something. He takes on the characteristics of the angels, of angelic beings. He becomes a mirror of the manifestation of God. The manifestation of God are the primary mirrors in creation of the light of God. The heart of the believer is a secondary mirror, but still it's a mirror. And the light that's in us, in that mirror, when it appears and shines in us, is the very light of God. It's not your light and my light. It's the light of God. That's the only source of light. So luminosity in the believers is coming from God. And he says that in one place, Abubakar talks about the love of God, how it pervades everything, and how it manifested in all the different forms of love. He says, even the pink in the cheeks of young maidens, he says, comes from the love of God. There are verses in the gleanings that you'll recall. He says that all good cometh from God, and all evil from your own selves. In case you wanted to find out, well, what part of me is my contribution and what part is God's contribution, that makes it pretty clear that you can discount everything that except the good part as your contribution. Now, how does it weigh up at the end of the day? Have you been serving him? In the sense of serving here would seem to be serving him in the sense of worship him. I bear witness that thou hast created me to know thee and to worship thee. And this worship of him is to glorify him in creation by manifesting his light and his quality, by becoming the embodiment of those divine attributes and having those influence our action and our words so that we uplift those that are around us, so that we make some positive contribution each day. You don't have to wait to go to China to do that. You know, we're here, we're right here. We can do that with each other to the extent, I mean, we have a wonderful, at least with fairly tolerant human beings around us, you know, willing to look for good qualities. There's some places in the world where people don't do that, but here there's a lot of possibility to share the feelings that we have with others and to nurture them and develop them. The concomitant of that, which is interesting when you're thinking about your year of service, that the service of the friends belongs to God, not to them. The service of the friends belongs to God, not to them. Perfectly in line with this other thing, all good comes from God and all evil is from you. If we're able to do anything, we are already, if you will, the instruments of heaven, the instruments of the kingdom. And getting ourselves out of the way so that those divine energies and forces can operate through that particular gift of qualities and attributes which makes up our reality and which can contribute unique things, because each one of us is crafted in a particular way by God to manifest his lights in a unique manner that no one else is going to be able to manifest. And if you don't manifest yours, they're never going to get manifested in that particular composition. That's what we want to do, is we want to fulfill our divine potential. And that means operating with that set of divine qualities, with that proportional set of the divine qualities and names of God that constitute our own innate reality. Now he goes on and starts dealing with this subject in different ways. The traditions and sayings that bear direct reference to our theme are diverse and manifold. We have refrained from quoting them for the sake of brevity. He cited just a few there. Nay, whatever is in the heavens and whatever is on the earth is a direct evidence of the revelation within it of the attributes and names of God. Inasmuch as within every atom are enshrined the signs that bear eloquent testimony to the revelation of that most great light. Methinks but for the potency of that revelation, no being could ever exist. How resplendent the luminaries of knowledge that shine in an atom, and how vast the oceans of wisdom that surge within a drop. To a supreme degree is this true of man, who among all created things hath been invested with the robe of such gifts, and hath been singled out for the glory of such distinction. For in him are potentially revealed all the attributes and names of God to a degree that no other created being hath excelled or surpassed. All these names and attributes are applicable to him. Even as he hath said, man is my mystery, and I am his mystery. Manifold are the verses that have been repeatedly revealed in all the heavenly books and the holy scriptures, expressive of this most subtle and lofty theme. Even as he hath revealed, we will surely show them our signs in the world and within themselves. Will ye not then behold the signs of God? And yet again he revealeth, and be ye not like those who forget God, in whom he hath therefore caused to forget their own selves. In this connection, he who is the eternal king, and this is a reference to Ali, the Imam Ali, may the souls of all that dwell within the mystic tabernacle be a sacrifice unto him, hath spoken. He hath known God, who hath known himself. I swear by God, O esteemed and honored friend. Again, he breaks from his theme and addresses the recipient of the tablet. He says, shouldst thou ponder these words in thine heart, thou wilt of a certainty find the doors of divine wisdom and infinite knowledge flung open before thy face. What a challenge this is to us also. From that which hath been said, it becometh evident that all things, in their inmost reality, testify to the revelation of the names and attributes of God within them. Each according to its capacity indicateth and is expressive of the knowledge of God. That is, the creation of anything presupposes the knowledge that God has of that thing before it comes into existence. If you want to create something, first you conceive it, you think of it, what is it? And then out of that pattern, out of that conception, you begin to draw the means together to bring it out into the world. If you want to produce a cake or whatever it is you want to produce, you've got this idea of the cake and the frosting and the whole thing, and then you start getting your ingredients together and you put it and you find it. So the cake is expressive of your knowledge of how to bake and how to create a cake. Now every created thing in that sense has to be expressive of the knowledge God has of it and has of it now at this very moment for it to exist. So likewise with the other names of God, but he says in this case he's talking about the knowledge. So potent and universal is this revelation that it hath encompassed all things visible and invisible. Thus hath he revealed, hath aught else save thee a power of revelation which is not possessed by thee, that it could have manifested thee? Blind is the eye which doth not perceive thee. Likewise hath the eternal king spoken, no thing have I perceived except that I perceived God within it, God before it, or God after it. Also in the tradition of Komeya, these are quotes from Ali, the Imam Ali still. Behold, a light hath shone forth out of the morn of eternity, and lo, its waves have penetrated the inmost reality of all men. Man, the noblest and most perfect of all created things, excelleth them all in the intensity of this revelation, and is a fuller expression of its glory. And of all men, the most accomplished, the most distinguished, and the most excellent are the manifestations of the Son of Truth. Nay, all else besides these manifestations live by the operation of their will and move and have their being through the outpourings of their grace. But for thee I would have not created the heavens. Nay, all in their holy presence fade into utter nothingness and are a thing forgotten. Human tongue can never befittingly sing their praise, and human speech can never unfold their mystery. These tabernacles of holiness, these primal mirrors which reflect the light of unfading glory, are but expressions of him who is the invisible of the invisible. By the revelation of these gems of divine virtue, all the names and attributes of God, such as knowledge and power, sovereignty and dominion, mercy and wisdom, glory, bounty and grace are made manifest. All human realities have the potential of manifesting all the names and attributes of God. The thing that seems to make us different is the proportion to which these names have been allotted to our nature. So we have a different set, if you will. We all have all of them, but within this spectrum, some bands are wider in some of us and smaller in others. And so you get the member of the local assembly that's always saying, "But friends, if we don't act in love, what are we doing?" And another one says, "But this is a local spiritual assembly and we should have justice. If we don't have justice, where will it come from in the world?" And another one says, "I think we should pray about this and think about this." These, if you will, are signs of those dominant names and attributes within our characters. They're different. We approach things in different ways. Now we get 9 people together, we get a composite of these things. It's fair enough to produce a respectable outcome. And even when we have personal problems, or we want guidance, we want to understand what to do, we don't just rely on ourselves. If we draw together a group of friends, or individually we consult with others and see what they think about a course of action or something we want to propose, we will see that reflected back under the influence of another set of qualities and experiences. And we will be drawn, I'm sure, to people that will be able to give us spiritual advice and can help us to see if what we're thinking or planning is in balance and makes good sense. And this is the whole thing, of course, of study class. Now, if we all contributed and talked about it, this would be a much richer experience. Unfortunately, I'm up here talking to you all the time. So we'll stop. Shall we stop? And I'll drink some water. Now, what do you have to say about this? Is there something that you would like to say, or a question, or anything about these first passages that we've been reading? There's no end to the reading and thinking about these passages. They're the whole doctrinal center of our faith, you know. There's more doctrinal truths here than I think in any other part of the book, in such a compact series of passages. Can I answer that with another question? Where else can we pray to? You know, because there is a tendency to think, well, I don't pray to the manifestation of God, I pray to God, you know? And we kind of react that way sometimes. Where is God to pray to? Where would you address yourself? Which direction would you turn? What thought would you conceive to address God? Any thought that comes in our mind, Abdu'l-Bahá says, we can be assured that's not God. If we're able to conceive it, that's not God. So he says the safer path is to address yourself to the manifestation of God, recalling that he is the channel of God's grace, that the light of God shines from the reality of the manifestation. So you center in the manifestation of God, and gradually you lose the image of his form and his person, and there's that force that's coming to you. You know, we address ourselves to God, maybe you can answer it this way. We address ourselves to God through the manifestation of God. Okay? How are you addressing your obligatory prayer to God? You're using Baha'u'llah's words that he's given you. How then are you addressing God except through Baha'u'llah, the means that Baha'u'llah is providing you to address him? So just in the fact that in the prayer you make that separation, because there is the separation. I mean, there is the essence of God, and we're able to address God, but we do it through the words Baha'u'llah has given us and through focusing ourselves on the light that shines from him. I think these two things together help to answer that question. You don't attain to God, but you address Him. And certainly we're free to address God, even though we can't conceive of God. And Shoghi Effendi says that the sincere souls in the need, even though they may not be believers of any, turn to God. God is the God of all creatures, and He will answer them. He responds to them. But he said it's more effective, your prayers are more effective if they're directed to God through the manifestation of God, because He's created the manifestations to be His representative, you know? And they are aware of our needs. And they are He who answers all prayers and, you know, attends to supplications and so on. The other thing is that Al-Baba says in a tablet that personality, in other words, a personal reality that you can address yourself to, is in the manifestations of God and not in the essence. The essence doesn't have a personality, so to speak, that one can address oneself to. And that the manifestation has been created for that purpose, because there's no way for the limited to address or approach the absolute. So he has a kind of relative absolute in the form of the manifestation of God in this realm that has, partakes of his powers, and yet is a human reality and has his own personality and qualities and his own beauty, his own role in history, and so on. But there are more quotations to put together to think about that. There's a number of answers, but by putting them all side by side, you begin to see why is it this way. Mm-hmm. David?
A different question. We've been reading passages about God being alone, and it made me think of passages in the New Testament that reading the Gospel of St. John, where it starts in the beginning with the Word, and the Word is God. I don't know if you can do this yourself, but
in the beginning was God, and the Word was with God. There's one of the earlier translations of that, they say more literally, is that the Word was God, or was a God, in the sense that the Word, which identified in by scriptures, would be the primal will. It's this middle, again, this middle kingdom, the intermediary kingdom. There was God, and there was the Word of God, and the Word of God was like a God under creation. He stands in the place of God to creation. And it's the Logos, it's against the principle of the Logos, it's the primal will again, operating in the center of things. There's those two realities, as I understand the explanation of that. The Master talks about that someplace. I think it was in Pilgrim Notes to one of the early, Ethel Rosenberg, where he actually interprets that verse and subsequent verses. I haven't seen it for a long time, but as I recall, that's the general approach that he takes. Yeah, we can see if we can find that. If God was alone, Baha'u'llah also says, think of the manifestation of God when he receives at the time he receives the knowledge of his revelation, and before he's spoken to anybody about it, before he's declared it, he has it all in himself. He likens this God was alone to that. This is an interesting parallel. The manifestation of God is like in a world, he has creation within him and he yet hasn't brought into being that creation, in the sense that each revelation calls into being a new creation. It raises up new souls, it recreates or causes the spiritual birth of a mass of souls in a time of darkness and starts a new creation. Somebody else? What else? I'm sure you're thinking lots of things. Please. Sausabil. Sausabil is again like a fountain. Let's see, what page is it? Oh. We had that earlier.
54.
Mm-hmm. I think 54 is where it first appears in the American edition. The name of a heavenly river or wellspring in paradise. It implies easy, sweet, soft-flowing waters. It derives from the Quran, chapter 76, verse 18. Salsabil. And it's found in combination with Kosar, which we've heard of too. Kothar or Kosar. Mm-hmm. Other ideas? Do you have the sources on? I haven't seen. We have all the sources on these quotes we've been reading here. The quotation on page 100, I am he himself and he is I myself. This has also been rendered in an alternative manner by Shoghi Effendi when he translated the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. And there it reads, manifold are our relationships with God. At one time we are he himself and he is we ourselves. At another, he is that he is and we are that we are. Now, this is again this twofold nature of the manifestation of God. On the one hand, he is the primal will. But on the other hand, he's his own reality. He's his own self, his own individuality. Man is my mystery is a tradition from Muhammad. The Eternal King, as I mentioned, is a reference to the Imam Ali. This is one of the titles. As to page 102, he hath known God who hath known himself. Baha'u'llah has elaborated on the meaning of this tradition attributed to the Imam Ali in a tablet to Mirza Hadiyeh Ghazvini, one of the letters of the living. In this tablet he reveals that this saying has unique and wondrous meanings in all of the worlds of God, in accordance with the exigencies of each world. Now, this is another thing. You memorize a verse of God, a hidden word or something, you'll find that that's coined in every realm. Wherever you go, it has different and distinct divine significances. And he explains about this. He says that no one who has failed to attain these worlds can grasp such meanings. You have to go to those worlds or attain to those worlds to understand them. In other tablets, he talks about how the soul of man is able to traverse various worlds while still walking on this earth. That as he takes on heavenly qualities and divine attributes, he becomes aware of the existence of different levels of truth and divine meaning. If all the oceans were converted to ink and all the pens on earth set to writing, it would not suffice to mention all these meanings of this single verse, he says, of God. A significant portion of the explanation which follows constitutes section 83 of the Gleanings. This is the same tablet that I'm mentioning here, page 164 to 166. It begins with the words, you'll recall this, consider the rational faculty. Hath aught else save thee a power is the prayer of the Imam Hussein. It's in the prayer of the day of Arafah. If you don't have that noted, you want to note the sources of some of these. The tradition of Komail, by this tradition is meant one of the traditions which Komail ibn Zayd al-Nakhai has related on the authority of the Imam Ali. It's been quoted in Bahar al-Anwar, is one of the great volumes of traditions, of Shia traditions. We'll come to that later on too. Komail was a devoted apostle of Ali who attained the crown of martyrdom through his love for him. Now, let's take a little look. Do you have if you have the outline there, I'm going to read it. A bit of the main themes here from part two. in your own reading, you'll want to go ahead. We started with the manifestations reveal undisputed sovereignty over all in heaven and earth. This theme is woven into the whole of the second part of the Gaon. We'll see, we'll be coming back now. Then we have the twofold purpose for the appearance of the manifestations. We read that. Then this section on God, the unknowable essence. Then the relationship between manifestations and the divine essence. Then the direct evidence of the names and attributes of God within all things. We will come back to this. This is called the universal revelation of God, one of the universal revelations of God. It's common to all times. That is, that creation itself is a revelation. One aspect of divine revelation is creation. It is an emanation, Abdu'l-Bahá says, from its maker. Man potentially reveals all the names and attributes to a supreme degree. The manifestations are the most accomplished, distinguished, and excellent of men. Every manifestation is a bearer and embodiment of all the names. Then it speaks about the failure of peoples to seek the inner meaning of God's words. Then there's a section of 6 pages on why the sovereignty of the Qa'im was not manifest. This was one of the problems of the Bab's uncles. The Qa'im, the promised one, was to come with the sovereignty and become ruler of the world, lord of the planet. Then he speaks under that theme of sovereignty as spiritual ascendancy, the example of Muhammad's sovereignty, the effects of allegiance to God's revelation. Then he elaborates some of the meanings of these symbolic terms, wolf and lamb, and their feeding together, and the meaning of life and death, and the last day, and resurrection, and judgment, and trumpet, and resurrection. Spiritual rebirth, examples from past scriptures, several pages. Spiritual sovereignty, superior to worldly dominion. And then he cites various authorities on this. Hussein, the son of Ali, talks about Jesus and Sadiq and the meaning of riches and poverty, the meaning of ascendancy, power and authority is also in that section. Finally, he deals with comprehending the inner meaning of sovereignty. The allegation, it talks about the allegation that the hand of God is chained up, that revelation is ended, and refutes that. Then he comes to the promise, a review of the theme of the promise of the attainment of the divine presence, particularly in the Quran. Over and over this is promised, and he analyzes this. What does this mean? What is the significance of divine presence and the promise that's given there? And in the process of that, he elaborates these 3 stages of divine revelation, pages 139 to 142. And gives the meaning of the term presence of God as attainment to the presence of His manifestation. He gives the meaning of the day of resurrection, describes this as a day there's no day that is mightier than this day of resurrection. Talks about the significance of one righteous work in this day. And then he deals with the fundamental purpose of all learning, which is the recognition of the manifestation. And he says how through this coming of the revelation, the abased shall be exalted and the exalted abased. It's a sign of this time. That takes us up to about the end of this first section of questions. So we'll go on with these themes next week. All right.